This is Anodized. On this episode, we'll be discussing the future of gaming. I'm Clinton Phillips, and joining me on this episode is Zach Saichi. How's it going, Zach?
Pretty good. How's it going, Clinton?
Yeah, very good. So for this episode, we're going to be talking about the future of gaming. But to do that, I think it's important to look at the current state of gaming. So we've just had two new consoles launch, and with Nintendo launched theirs a year before. I think looking at some sales numbers, it's hard to get consistent numbers together, but it seems to be that there's still a lot of interest in gaming consoles these days. So have you been looking at all the numbers at all?
I've been looking at the sort of the Xbox One and the PS4, and also quite a bit at Nintendo, just to kind of see what the general direction of that seems to be. One of the interesting things I think about the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4 launch is it's very, very difficult. Like, I'm looking here at the numbers you have. So 3 million Xbox Ones sold by the end of 2013, and 4.2 million PlayStation 4 sold by the end of 2013. Just out of curiosity, where did these particular numbers come from?
These came from Wikipedia, and
okay.
I found it really hard to get consistent sales numbers because different sources are reporting different numbers. Like, there'd be sales within 24 hours, or
right.
Sales within this time period, or sales for this region. So it was very hard to nail down a worldwide figure for equal time periods for both, because I mean you want to compare apples to apples, don't you?
Yeah, it's a massive pain. So I was actually trying to write an article about sort of the Wii U sales, and comparing the 3DS to the original DS and that sort of thing. And I was using VGCharts.com, I believe, as a source. And the more and more I was writing it, the more I realized half these numbers kind of look bogus to me, because the problem is that they all were sort of counting differently. And even on VGCharts.com, it's like they didn't seem to have any one way that they were getting those numbers or arriving at those conclusions. And the other problem is, so like, let's say you're taking a look at the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4. If you look at just a launch in and of itself, there are so many factors that go into a launch that don't necessarily get taken into account by, say, a casual, analyst. The problem is that the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4, they sort of launched into different regions and at different price points and at slightly different times.
Yeah.
So I can't remember which one actually came out first. The Xbox One, right?
Yes, I believe it was, but right, only by a few weeks, really.
Yeah, I can't. Maybe it was the PlayStation 4 that came out first.
It depends by which region you go, because
I
think it was Xbox One first in America, and then PlayStation 4 came out after that.
Right. So you can kind of take these two numbers here and say, okay, well, it looks like the PlayStation 4 maybe did a little bit better, but I'm not comfortable with that because the data just isn't very, very reliable. And the final numbers that get counted, it seems like there's too many factors that don't necessarily get taken into account. I think the PlayStation 4 hasn't even launched in Japan yet. I think it comes out maybe like next month.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that you'd think would probably be the place where that would have the most sales.
And well, honestly, you'd think that the PS4 would launch in Japan first and then everywhere else, but it's a bit of an odd move by Sony on that.
Yeah, I mean, that in and of itself is a bit of a conundrum. Maybe because of they knew the Xbox One was coming out, they wanted to get sort of a head start there, and maybe the titles specific to Japan were not quite ready. I don't know. It is interesting that they chose to do that. But so I don't know. My overall takeaway from the from the initial sales numbers is that just not a whole lot can be drawn from it, other than you can kind of take a look at the two and say, wow, okay, so console gaming is still a thing. Like there are still there's still tons of interest in console gaming.
Yeah, and that's sort of why I've picked now to discuss this, because we've had the two new consoles launch. So it's sort of a good indicator of how much interest there is in console gaming at the moment, and certainly this will be the generation to watch and to see how, if the interest can be maintained over the years, because this will be really an indicator of whether there's going to be more consoles in the future.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I don't know, the way I kind of look at it is like we're all looking at the current generation of consoles as kind of like when Blu-ray, you know, hit the scene with video. Everyone kind of like mutually agreed, like, okay, this is probably it. Like, this is probably the last, you know, popular physical format for movies that we're going to have. And there seems to be this kind of sense that the similar thing is going to happen with console gaming, where eventually there just won't be as large of a market for dedicated machines. And even if there is a market for dedicated machines, there's sort of this sense that, well, there's probably going to be kind of like one, maybe two. And it'll probably be something that will do a lot more than just play you know, dedicated games. And in a way, we're kind of seeing that, because these are really more media boxes than just straight consoles.
Yeah, there was a lot of complaints from gamers when the Xbox One launched that, you know, well, this is a box for watching TV that also happens to play games. You know, the console manufacturers are trying to diversify what these boxes can do to make them more useful, to sort of to really give people more reasons to buy them. You know, it's not just a box that plays games. You can also watch Netflix and whatever else on it.
Yeah, it's... There's a lot of things that come up for me with this. So, taking a look at it, it's hard for... I kind of don't think that this is the last generation of consoles. This might be the last, like, big hurrah, I guess. I have a hard time imagining a scenario where in 5 or 6 or 10 years, all three of these companies decide to launch, you know, brand new consoles, and the launches look, you know, like this. It you know, I'm kind of with a lot of other people, and I think that there's probably things that are going to happen between now and then that'll make that difficult. But at the same time, those things that we kind of theorize are going to happen haven't really happened yet. And that's exactly why we just had these launches be so successful. You know, obviously Apple has not made any moves in this space. You know, and other companies with sort of all in one boxes, who we think might be, you know, sort of dark horses to do things maybe with gaming. Well, those things really haven't kind of happened yet, and it's really mostly just guessing and sort of just maybe looking at the mobile market and drawing conclusions that I don't know. I'd be uncomfortable saying that it's absolutely the last generation of consoles. But, you know, I don't know. I think the most interesting story, though, is kind of Nintendo, because you had the massive success of the Wii.
Yeah, that was hugely successful. I mean, that brought them back from, you know, they were getting dangerously close to bankruptcy, and the Wii sort of saved them.
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I think that the Wii... You know, in total, it's the most successful console of the last generation, which is weird because it kind of tapered off. It sort of tapered off and never really came back. And you know, I think it's had sold so many units that the Xbox 360 and the PS3 just will never quite catch up. But then you have the release of the Wii U. And it's like they're taking this nosedive right back to where they were back with the GameCube. That's sort of interesting to me, and it's hard to know what that means. Obviously, today it came out that sales are not anywhere near where they, you know, where shareholders want them to be, and you know, you have the president of Nintendo saying like, well, I'm not going to resign. So that's not good. Like, one of the interesting things that's happening with Nintendo and sort of the community of people that sort of defend Nintendo is that you have a lot of people who say, well, no, Nintendo will be just fine because, you know, they've always had the handheld business. And today that's absolutely true. Like, the 3DS is actually way up. The sort of the problem there is the way that I kind of approach that whole thing is I take a look at the history of the company and try to put it into some context. And also the fact that they're public now. You know, they weren't always. I think that's actually fairly recent within the last maybe decade and a half development is that they're public now.
Okay.
So, yeah, the interesting thing about Nintendo is that the Wii U is actually it's a pretty good mirror actually to the GameCube back in, I don't know, 2004, 2006. I probably have my time frame a little wrong there, but it's doing very similar numbers. Like, if you take a look at what were the first couple of years of the GameCube versus what of the first, you know, what is the first year and a half of the Wii U been, the sales are kind of similar in that it's really only pushed a few million in the total lifespan. But the weird thing is that with the GameCube, you had some sales spikes with, you know, particular games. So, like, Super Mario Sunshine came out, or maybe Zelda Wind Waker came out, and kind of pushed things forward a bit, and they were able to kind of sustain a little bit. And the console was so cheap that they were still able to keep it afloat, I guess.
Yeah.
But with the Wii U, they've poured in a little bit more money than they did with the GameCube, and a little bit more research and development, and the console's more expensive than the GameCube was when it came out. And interestingly enough, they came out with a flagship title, which was Super Mario 3D World. And it doesn't seem to have created it didn't seem to create a spike at all. The Wii U is kind of just sort of still selling the same sort of paltry amount that it was before. So it looks kind of like they're in trouble. Like they're in a situation that they haven't ever quite been in before. In that the console, I think the margins on it are not that great. So they're actually losing money on it. And then they've got the handheld business, which is doing very good, but it's not quite where the original DS was at the same, again, at the same time and into its lifespan. The only thing they have really going for them is that they've kind of got a little bit of a cash hoard saved up from the Wii, you know, being so successful. So they're a little bit impervious there, but because they're a public company, you know, any company you want growth, right? It's not an acceptable outcome that, you know, you do wonderful for 2 years straight in a row
and then you sort of stagnate for another 2 years.
Yeah. Or yeah, well, sort of the argument that you see in the community of Nintendo is that, well, you know, they can kind of just reach into their piggy bank and be fine for the next, like, you know, some people have said, well, they could actually just use that money for the next decade and they'd be totally fine. They wouldn't have any problems. No, that's completely inaccurate. Because they're a public company, because that, you know, there's people, there are shareholders that want value and, you know, want profit, that they need to be doing well. They can't just keep reaching, you know, into their savings or whatever. That's just not how things work. So I think Nintendo could very well be in a bit of a panic state right now, trying to figure out what the heck to do in the next 2 years. I do think they have a little bit of time, but I don't think it's that much time.
No, I think they kind of need to do something now. I think that the things that they're doing at the moment is, you know, cutting the prices of their hardware, trying to boost some more sales, but, you know, sort of try to make it up in volume what they're losing on the profits margin. But you know, that they need to do do something to better explain to customers, you know, why you should buy a Wii U. Because I think that's one of the reasons why it's not doing so well, because people are confused as to what the Wii U is. You know, is it a new console or is it an accessory for the Wii?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's interesting because Nintendo themselves haven't really commented on it that way. It makes you wonder if they're aware of that problem as much as they need to be. Because
you do have to wonder, because like the market needs some education in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, if you even just like the Wii U box art, like you walk in, I walk into my local Target and I just take a look at the Wii U. And the thing that's most emphasized on the box is that big gigantic controller, and it looks kind of interesting. And then I see the price tag and I go, it's $300. What is this? Is just a thing for my Wii? I mean, I know better, but I think a lot of parents, it's a confusing message, and also I think that the controller concept itself. You know, even if consumers are not confused and even if they know that it's a brand new console, I think that with the original Wii, you had motion gaming that came onto the scene and kind of, you know, it captured people's imaginations. People
got really excited about that. And you look at how successful Wii Sports was, and, you know, everyone would, they get their Wii in the Wii Sports, and I'm going to play tennis. And I play tennis by waving my arm. You know, it's something that people haven't been able to do with a game console. You know, if you want to do that, you have to go play real tennis, and who wants to go do that?
Right.
So this was something novel and exciting, and it really captured the imagination of casual gamers and people who traditionally haven't been gamers. You know, they've probably never bought a console before in their life. But, hey, I can wave this thing around and it makes things happen on the screen. That's cool. That's exciting. So they really got into it. But, with this one, there's not that sort of... not that excitement level with the Wii U. So people are, you know, perhaps not... that they just don't see a reason to buy an entirely new console when they have their Wii that works perfectly fine.
Yeah, you know, I linked to a really good article about Nintendo, the sort of their philosophy about how they choose to use technology and leverage it. I think it was called I can't remember who wrote it. I linked to it on my website, so you can. Maybe throw a link in the show notes, but lateral thinking with withered technology, I believe, is the name of the article. And basically, it talked about how any time that Nintendo has kind of sort of taken older technology that's been kind of laying around and done something novel with it, or done something truly truly new and unique. That's when they've been successful. And any time when they've tried to sort of compete on the basis of specs is when they've been not so successful.
Yeah, because I remember when the Wii U first came out, everyone was saying, oh, it's more powerful than an Xbox 360. And you think, yeah, but the next Xbox is just around the corner and that's going to beat hell out of the Wii U. It's going to be more powerful again. So it seemed pointless to be, trying to sell it on it's more powerful than a 360.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have much deeper differences that are at this point a problem. So even when the Wii U first came out, maybe the graphics in some ways are a little bit better than the PS3 or the Xbox 360, but the kinds of games being made on the Wii are not the kinds of games being made on the Xbox and the PS3. No. So to a lot of gamers, it just doesn't make any difference. They can't play The Last of Us on their Wii U. They can't play, you know, the latest, you know, awesome first-person shooter or whatever on their Wii U. So, and honestly, the jump in graphics is not that significant over the PS3 and the Xbox. So, yeah, I mean, trying to compete on that basis, just I think I don't know if it was a. If it was a mistake, but you know, actually, so going back to that tablet controller, I think Nintendo thinks it's novel and interesting, Yeah, like yeah. I honestly think that the implementation side of it really kind of is, because no one else is doing quite what they're doing. The problem is it's just not quite interesting enough in a world of you know, people who have iPads and iPhones and you know, all kinds of different, you know, you have things like AirPlay and you have the Chromecast. You have all these different things that, you know, you can throw things at your screen, and you have smart TVs. Like, people are kind of used to this stuff. And I think that people look at the Wii U and they just think, yeah, but so what? You know, it's, yeah, that's cool. I'd maybe get one if it was maybe a little cheaper. But, like, no matter what, even if they lower the price or whatever, it's not going to capture people's imaginations. Not in the way that the original Wii did. Not in the way that the original, you know, the Super Mario 64 did with the, you know, introducing the analog control stick, you know?
Yeah.
That's their problem. It's hard for me to imagine what they can do with regards to input method, and so many other things that I wonder how much they have left in them to do interesting things in the console space, because I think that the competition is just, it's moved to a different place. You know, the Xbox and the PS3, they enable such a variety of experience that, you know, with Nintendo, you're really only kind of getting one kind of experience, which is sort of the Nintendo, you know, first party and second party titles that are very, very good. They're great, you know, but I don't think it's enough anymore. I think that the sales numbers, you know, with Super Mario 3D World not really moving Wii U's, I think it kind of proves that, you know, back in the early 90s, there was like a survey done, you know, seeing how popular is like Mario. And at one point, Mario was like more known, more like of a household name than Mickey Mouse. You know, it was huge. That's I'm not sure exactly how accurate that is. That's from the book Game Over by David Sheff, a really great book about Nintendo. But again, you look at this now, and like Mario is not enough. I don't think Zelda, you know, it's not enough. I think in the mobile space, in the you know, handheld gaming space, they're a little bit more protected, because I think parents and, you know, people are just a lot more willing to go for something like that. It's a lot,
yeah.
It's a lot cheaper. But yeah, they have a terrible narrative problem, I think, with the living room right now. They don't have a game that's going to sell that controller. I don't think they will, and they're not captivating people the way that Nintendo, you know, is capable of, I think.
Yes, they really need something that takes full advantage of having that big controller to really make people go, okay, well, this is a must-have game, this is a must-have console.
And, right.
And you really have to work to explain, well, what is it about the controller that makes it unique? What sort of experiences can you have on that? And it's hard to do that with static pictures. You have to do that. You have to do a lot of video sort of advertising, that sort of thing to really get across that message that this is what you can do with it. This is why you should have it.
Yeah.
Because you look at a picture in a catalog, or the picture even on the box, and you go, well, yeah, it's a tablet. I have a tablet. But it's not really saying, well, what's the unique experience that you can have with this particular tablet and this console hooked up to your screen? That's what they need to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, and Nintendo's sort of been here before, where they release something that is genuinely very, very cool, but they have a terrible time figuring out the narrative. You know, how are we going to sell this to people? They were here with the Virtual Boy, you know. Which everyone sort of unanimously says was a pile of junk and you know, didn't sell and was, you know, their biggest disaster. I agree it was their biggest disaster, but it was not a piece of junk. I actually still have one laying around somewhere. But, I mean, it was actually very interesting. It was kind of cool. But all it took to sync that thing was just, you know, the sort of this message that, oh, well, it kind of gives you headaches after, you know, 15 minutes of playing it. And, you know, it's expensive. And, you know, it was also very difficult to get across what that experience was like in screenshots and in marketing. So they had this kind of crazy, like, marketing that was all about, you know, going into the game. And it was kind of during a time when people were excited about VR and, you know, the, sort of the possibilities of, you know, being immersed in a virtual world and all that. But Nintendo comes out and they have this console that you kind of can't take around with you. It's sort of a thing that you have to sit at a desk and you know, plop your eyes into it. Like, there's just no good family message there. There's no... Yeah. It was very cool. Like, to this day, I've never played a console that got me, like, more immersed into a game than the Virtual Boy did. But the, you know, you're plopping your eyes into this thing, and you're sort of escaping from your family. It's not something to be enjoyed, you know, with you know, more than one person. So
yeah, because that's been the best thing about Nintendo is when you have one of their consoles, and it kind of becomes a shared experience. Because I remember playing Donkey Kong with my brothers and sisters, and you know, that was, we'd all sit in the lounge room, and one of us would play, and we'd all just sit there and watch. Because it was just that entertaining, that fun, that you didn't have to be playing to have fun with the game. You could just watch someone else, and that was fun enough.
Right. Yeah, no, and that's always kind of been the appeal of Nintendo. And, you know, and today, even with the 3DS, they had a hard time selling people in the 3D feature.
Yeah.
Because you kind of have to look at it at the right angle to be able to see the 3D properly. And for a lot of people who with maybe bad vision or, you know, whatever kind of issue, it maybe would give them headaches. You know, they sort of ran into the exact same problem with the 3DS, but with there, at least you can turn it off and it's not that big a deal. And they're still able to sell the thing on the basis of the games. But yeah, with the living room, anything that's gonna, you know, primarily like stay home, I don't know what they can do, to be honest. And I think they're struggling. I think you can kind of see it in the software they are releasing. You know, I think it's really great stuff, but they're very much relying on old IP. They're not, you know, they're not releasing brand new titles, and even the ones. You know, even the ones with the current IP, you know, they used to take Mario and totally reinvent it. You know, for each new console generation. You know, so you think back to the original Super Mario Brothers. No one had ever seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
And you go to just a few years later with Super Mario Brothers 3. And that really reinvented what the original game was by introducing this big world that, you know, multiple worlds that you could kind of travel between. And, you know, it introduced a lot of really complex, interesting concepts. And then you go to like Super Mario World, and that, you know, no one had seen graphics like that. And, you know, it really refined what Super Mario Brothers 3 was. And then you have this massive jump over to Super Mario 64, which just totally changed everything. And anyone who was... This is hard to explain to people who maybe didn't experience it firsthand, but, like, the feeling that you got when you played Super Mario 64 for the first time, and I think it was, like, late 95, 96.
Yeah,
The feeling that you got was just... It was just phenomenal. You know, in the same way that, like, when I got my first iPhone, you know, and experienced that for the first time, that's what it was like playing the original, you know, Super Mario 64.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was genuinely, and it took a long time for everyone else to kind of catch up with what Mario 64 had introduced with the analog stick and you know, very, very sensitive, you could barely like push the analog stick forward, and Mario would kind of like, you know, crawl forward, and just really subtle things that showed a lot of polish and detail. to the experience, and they haven't done this in a long, long time, where they just sort of turned gaming on its head, and you know, did something that no one else had thought of. You know, and you look to the titles they're releasing today. Well, they haven't really reinvented Mario in an awful long time. You know, arguably maybe Super Mario Galaxy. They kind of really changed it up, but you're still talking about core gameplay concepts that you know were introduced with Mario 64. It doesn't do anything to sell you on the tablet controller. I'll just put it that way.
No, it doesn't. And something that is a complaint that I hear from gamers a lot, that you know, Nintendo is relying on their old IP quite a lot, and you know, whenever they announce a new game, they go, "Oh, look, it's another Zelda game, and it's going to be exactly the same as the last one." You know, that's the sort of facetious comment that you hear a lot of. So you kind of wonder if people are getting tired of just having, "Oh, look, it's another Mario game, it's another Zelda game." It's, you know, kind of looking for different things.
Yeah, and you know, I think Nintendo thinks that they can sell these systems on the basis of the IP, because the last really big Wii U announcement, they showed off, I think there was a new Donkey Kong Country game that was sort of a big title that they're pushing. And they also announced this new Zelda game called, like, I can't even remember the name of it, Hyrule Warriors or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And yeah, basically, it's not even developed. It's not a first party title. It's a thing where I think they brought in Tecmo, maybe. I can't remember which company they brought in, but I think are the makers of Dynasty Warriors. And basically, this is Dynasty Warriors, but with Zelda characters. And you know, Nintendo licensed out you know, Zelda, and they're making this sort of it's not a radical new entry into the Zelda franchise. This is clearly something where they said, okay, well, we're working on a new Zelda, like a new really big great Zelda game in the background, but we're not going to have it out soon, so we kind of need to get a Zelda title out there. And that's what this kind of looks like. But I think they're confused, to be honest, because I don't think that's going to work. I don't think that they can sell Wii U's on the basis of IP alone. At the very least, they need a massive drop in the price of the console, which I don't think they can even do. I've heard the sentiment from a lot of gamers, like, yeah, I'd totally get one if it were $199.
Yeah,
you know, that, and that does make a difference in the history of consoles. Quite often, you know, something like a $100 price point is enough to sort of save a console from, you know, from death. So you know, and I think that can still happen, but with the Wii U, the margins really suck, and they're kind of already losing money on it. There's really only so far down they can go. They'd have to be selling a lot of software in order to make up for any further price drops there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and again, that's what sort of sets it apart from the situation with the GameCube, where they were not doing so well, but they were kind of able to recover because at least the GameCube didn't cost that much to manufacture, and there wasn't a ton to it. You know, but the Wii U, they've already got this big tablet controller thing that they kind of can't drop because all the games support it. You know,
integral to the system.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I've sort of posited is that, well, maybe what they can do is they can drop that controller, drop the price by $100, you know, and see what happens. But I haven't played the Wii U enough to know, but I believe that's almost impossible because there's a bunch of games that just require that controller. So unless if they were able to go in and update the games or something, I don't think it would work. So, yeah, I don't know.
There's another thing with the Wii U's. Like to play for multiplayer gaming, like some people get confused as, what do I have to buy another one of those multi-$100 tablets to be able to have two people play the games at the same time? And
yeah.
I think a lot of the games, it's okay, one person has the tablet and everyone else has the Wiimotes, and that's how they play.
Very confusing narrative. Yes. And not to mention the fact that the tech is kind of impressive, but it's actually not that good, because as soon as you introduce a second one of those things to the mix, the frame rate of your game actually drops in half.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because, you know, it's having to push, you know, all that stuff to multiple units. I honestly don't know which games are even capable of doing it. I think today, like, you still can't even buy a second controller in the United States. There has to be like two people with Wii U's that, you know, you bring the controller over to someone's house. I don't know. Like over in Japan, I know you can buy the controller separately. Mm. Again, like they just have these fundamental narrative issues and things where it doesn't feel like they've thought things out quite enough. And then there's a whole other sub piece to this. So, which is the fact that they kind of don't understand online purchasing and how that really ought to work.
Yeah.
You know, my biggest complaint about my 2DS is that it doesn't, you know, when I buy an app or a game on iOS, I kind of feel like I own that forever. I mean, there's all kinds of factors that might come into that to where, you know, maybe the thing will get pulled and I'll never have access to it again. But for by and large, you know, for the most part,
as long as you got it on your hard drive, backed up in iTunes, you have that app forever.
Well, that and for the most part, it's all in iCloud. You know, for the most part, there's a few things that have actually just genuinely gotten pulled. But, you know, I can go through my purchase history and go all the way back to when the App Store first launched, and I can find all kinds of old stuff. Whereas the way they've got things set up with the eShop, they don't even keep track of your purchases. You know, you can't just go buy another system and then re-download the same title. And then you've got this other situation with their virtual console games. And, you know, if you buy Super Mario Brothers 3 on one, you don't have it on the other. You have to buy it again on the other system.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so
That's not good at all.
Yeah, and it's sort of... people keep saying to me that's not that big of a deal, but I actually think it's a very big deal.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just a bad message, and I think the word of mouth kind of spreads that it's just sort of a pain in the ass to deal with. You know, the only way to transfer games from like one to the other is to go through this sort of ridiculous process that doesn't really make any sense. And then there's they've finally removed the console limit. It used to be that you could only like transfer games from one device to the other five times before they'd expire. And they just lifted that.
Weren't they would have been putting that in an attempt to curb piracy, because I remember hearing at some point that the DS is the most pirated system out there, like DS games.
Sure. Yeah, that's probably true. They don't seem to understand what the right thing to do is there. You know, I think that one of their biggest assets is their virtual console library, and I think that if they had a really strong message that you can go back and, you know, play all these old games and they'll work on your, you know, on your 2DS or your 3DS and on your Wii. And you know, you only have to buy them once and they'll work across both, which, by the way, for them would not be terribly difficult to do. I mean, the programming involved to move one to the other is not, you know, it's not a ton of cost, I guess. I think that would be a very strong message. You know, it would be something, at least. It would be an advantage. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, well, for many years, like, because when the Wii first came out, I heard that you could download old titles on it, and that was the thing that I was most interested in about getting a Wii 4 so that I could play old Super Nintendo games. But I never looked into it. I never investigated that, which is why I don't have a Wii U or any other Nintendo stuff at the moment, because I've just never looked into that further, but that I think is the strongest selling point for me, is that look, you can play all this old stuff that, I still have my Super Nintendo, but to hook it up to a TV, I need a working VCR.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and then you have like alternative things like this Ouya I just got, where you can, you know, just emulate all these old games. You know, and I don't think that the average person does that sort of thing. It's not that big of a deal. But that's the thing. Nintendo's doing all this stuff to sort of curb piracy, and who cares? Like, that these are people that probably would not have bought these things anyway. And even if some of them were going to buy that stuff, well, you're not making it available to them, you know?
Hmm.
So it's something where I think that they should concentrate. It's because I think that if they were able to understand something that simple, they might maybe get some of their other thinking straightened out about online. You know, you still have to exchange these ridiculous codes just to be able to play a friend online, which
yeah,
I think
they're crazy long, aren't they?
They are. They used to be 14 digits. I believe they're a little wow. shorter now. I don't really know because I'm not that big of an online gamer, so I honestly haven't exchanged my code with anybody. But yeah, I don't know. They seem to be a bit confused right now. And you know, I think that the thing that they really need to do more than anything is just concentrate on building the best games. And I think if we're being honest, they're not making the best games. I think that they're making great ones, but I don't think they're making the games that are pushing gaming forward. You know, I think that if you want the games that are pushing gaming forward and sort of changing the narrative of what a game can be, your Nintendo is not the console for you. You're probably going to go for something like a PS3 or an Xbox. And that's their biggest problem. Like, even when Nintendo's always been about family, you know, sort of family-oriented experience, family-oriented games. But even in the midst of that, they were still changing the narrative of what a game can be very, very consistently, doing very experimental things that were huge successes. I mean, you can go all the way back to something silly like Mario Paint, where, you know...
I had Mario Paint. That was great. Loved
right,
that.
Right. Yeah, and it's funny because, like, it's stuff like that they're not doing today, you know, where they sort of change the basis of what a game can be, you know. Things like the Super Scope. I mean, maybe the Super Scope wasn't that successful. I don't know. But, like, it showed a creativity on their part in a, you know, genuine wanting to push things forward. And Super Mario 3D Land isn't doing that. It's a really great Mario game, but, you know, it's basically taking all of the elements of things that we've already seen and packaging them nicely into sort of a, you know, greatest hits package, basically.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know what they can do other than, you know, refocus on the games. But again, because they're public now, they sort of have this problem where they need to...
They're beholden to shareholders.
Yeah, yeah. They're really they surprised me when they went public. Again, I can't remember what year it was, but they don't seem like the kind of company that benefits much from being public. Because well, I guess I don't know. It might have made more sense at the time. They were just coming off of the N64, which did really well, sorta, kinda, but then started to kind of do badly. You know, then they had the GameCube. There was sort of this period where they were really kind of, it was handheld that was keeping them afloat more than anything. So yeah. You know, and so maybe they thought going public would help them in some way in terms of having some backing for R&D and all that to move forward into the next generations or whatever. But now they're just sort of beholden to it.
Yeah, it just hasn't put them in a good situation at the moment.
Right. I mean, I think they're just sort of in panic mode. Like nothing they're doing is really working, other than on the handheld side. And even that, I think they'd be a lot happier if it was doing much better than it is. So, you know, again, it's, you know, for the 3DS to be doing as well as the DS was doing before, well, that's not that great. Again, companies want growth. Companies want to do better each time. And I think that's sort of the fundamental problem. So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. I kind of have I have a lot of hope that they'll figure it out. Yeah. But you know, like with the news today, I don't think they're impervious. I think that they very well could be sort of in panic mode right now, and there could even be management shakeup. You know, the president might go out, might bring someone new in. You know, the culture of the company might wind up changing, and who knows? They might even, you know, do something as crazy as sell to somebody else at some point. Who knows? You know.
Yeah. So I sort of think for the future in Nintendo, they kind of got two ways that they can go. They can either, you know, do something that saves themselves, or they can go down the same route that Sega did and just stop making hardware and just go back to making just games by themselves.
And that would be a shame.
Having that on other consoles, and yeah, it would be a shame.
You know, Sega's kind of doing pretty good right now as a software developer, but I think most gamers would agree that they are like a shadow of what they were before. You know,
absolutely, yeah.
They really, you know, sort of like Nintendo, they represented something. You know, with the Genesis, and you know, even the Saturn and the Dreamcast, and you know, ultimately they died, but but you know, they were making really, really great stuff, and they believed in, you know, the same things that Nintendo believes in. It just didn't work out because they lost a lot of money on a lot of different things. It wasn't any one thing that sort of caused Sega to go down that path. But yeah, that's probably a longer subject for another day, maybe.
Yeah. One thing that you brought up in there was you know, old games and emulation, and you know, so that's one thing that I sort of look at with the PS4 and the Xbox One. Neither of them have any sort of backwards compatibility. So if you buy one of these new consoles, or traditionally, if you buy a new console, you'd have access to the back catalogue of games from the previous generation, but you don't have that capability with the new consoles because they're running totally different architecture, and neither company has put any effort into like emulating the old one. It's probably going to be too hard anyway.
Yeah.
But one thing that I really hope doesn't happen is that as gaming goes forward, that we don't lose what we've had in previous years, because it's just such a shame that there are so many great titles out there that aren't readily playable because of, you know, companies either going out of existence or, you know, they're not supporting their old games, not bringing it forward to work on modern systems.
Yeah, the Sega Saturn's kind of a great example of that. There's so many games that came out for the Sega Saturn that were just, like, mind-blowingly good, like Panzer Dragoon Saga, for example, that you cannot play today. If you want to play Panzer Dragoon Saga, you've got to go track down a Saturn. You've got to track down that game, which, by the way, runs somewhere around you know, $200 and up on eBay.
Wow.
Yeah, and I actually have a copy. But anyway, I worry about that too. I think it would be a shame if you know, a lot of titles just sort of got lost, and we're already kind of seeing that. I can think of a lot of games that just have not been brought forward. You know, all these consoles have some sort of shop to be able to buy like old games, but they're kind of mostly the best sellers. They don't,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're not doing a whole lot to bring in the obscure titles. Whereas what I would really like to see is maybe, you know, for like say Sony to reach into their back catalog of say games that weren't even released in certain territories, and maybe,
yeah,
yeah, that, I mean, they don't even need to translate them, just make them available, you know. Translating them wouldn't be that big of a deal, please do, but just make them available in some way, you know? It's something that Squaresoft could do with a lot of their old titles that they, you know, people complain all the time about titles that Square, you know, brought to one place but didn't bring to another place. And you might say, well, there's not that much value in that, and you know, but this is a company that does endless ports of some you know, so many games and brings it to like every other platform. It's like, would it, how much of a drop in the bucket would it really be to do that sort of thing? You know, it's not even about making money off of any one title. It's again about like having like a narrative of, you know, we care. You know, it's worth preserving these things, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I do see that missing with games. You don't have, so in like with movies, you have like the Criterion Collection, and they sort of go out of their way to save films and you know, save them for posterity or whatever, and you know, have them in their original presentation as best as humanly possible, to go back and remaster it, find any extra material they can find, and sort of package it together. And we don't have anything equivalent to that in games. And that's frustrating for anybody who is really big on the history of video games.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that all of that sort of stirs up for me, you were talking about the fact that these new consoles don't have, you know, proper backwards compatibility. So going forward, I think what's interesting about the backwards compatibility thing is you look at what's going on in mobile, in particular, and the fact that you know, with Android phones or with iOS, you know, iPads and iPhones, games and apps, you know, are 100% backwards compatible because they're carrying the same architecture forward, right? And I think that's interesting. I don't quite know what it means for, you know, the future of game consoles, but I see that as being a very interesting advantage of the way that, say, Apple does things or other companies could do things in terms of just architecture. I think that's a very compelling idea that you're able to carry all of your purchased things forward into each, you know, into each new upgrade, I guess.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, with these big consoles, you're kind of just sort of stuck to keep the old console around if you really want to be able to play all of the old games. You know, maybe a few will be made available, and maybe a bunch of them will be, you know, maybe backwards compatible down the road or something like that. But you almost never get like 100% backwards compatibility. So I don't know. That's sort of an interesting thing in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, with the PS3, I think they just put like the entire PS2 inside it, and eventually they removed that.
Yeah.
From the system in one of the updates, because, you know, perhaps nobody was really using it. But yeah, they've just decided that, look, we're not gonna support backwards compatibility on the new systems, and I really hope that we'll get a lot more old games ported to the Xbox One and the PS4, you know, from the previous generations, to just being made available on their online stores as digital downloads. You know, that sort of thing would be fantastic, and would just really open up the catalog for new players to see what's yeah, to see what games are out there, because there's just so many great old games that you know, a lot of people will just miss out on because of the different times that they get into gaming, or perhaps the different platforms that they get onto, because you know, they're always platform exclusives that you have to have a certain system to be able to play them, and not everyone has every console. You know, they're definitely in the minority if you have all three.
Yeah, no, most sane people don't have you know, all,
yeah, they
all
they
three.
Pick one, maybe two. Like the usual thing would be you have either a PS4 or a PlayStation or an Xbox, and maybe you'd have a Nintendo Wii as well.
Yeah,
but it's rare that you find someone with all three.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, That's what makes the question of like what if Apple enables games on say an Apple TV in the future or whatever. That's what makes that such a compelling thing, is because you look at what these companies are doing with app ecosystems in mobile, and it kind of crushes what everyone's doing in the console space. Like that's a huge advantage that they could have. But you know, in and of itself, it probably, I don't know, maybe it doesn't mean a whole lot. But I don't know, like going back to the sort of the future of game consoles and whether or not they can remain relevant, I think the reason why there's sort of this sense that this might be the last generation of game consoles is, I don't know, did you see that, have you read any of Horace's articles about gaming?
No, I haven't seen any of that stuff.
Okay, so he did a couple articles. One of them was called Game Over, and he basically, you know, took a brief look at the video game market as a whole, and kind of came to the conclusion that the problem with game consoles in general is that if you look at the length of time that game consoles have been around versus the amount of adoption that they've had, that it's kind of pathetic next to, say, like the adoption curve of the DVD player or the adoption curve of mobile phones. You see steady growth, but it's still to this day, as much money as in gaming and all of these things, it's still not mainstream in the same way. It's not 100% ubiquitous. So he took a look at that and basically came to the conclusion that it's just inevitable that eventually these things will be subsumed, you know, or integrated into something else, you know. And if you kind of look at like, you know, game consoles, he did this other graph where he basically took, I don't know, it was a crazy, crazy graph where he took like the last 100 years of new technologies that have entered the scene. And sort of like mapped out, it was life expectancy of a person going down one axis over the last 100 years versus on the other axis, all of these new technologies that were introduced over the last 100 years. And sort of what you'd see is that the life expectancy of a person went up as certain like breakthroughs were made in technology. And you could look at things like the adoption of the, you know, the phone, the automobile and, you know, the computer, all of these different things. And you could kind of see like which ones were adopted quickly, which ones took a while to become adopted, which ones, you know, were introduced early, but you didn't see a spike until like later on, but then there was a huge spike. And you kind of see game consoles in this like last 100 years graph, and it's just kind of a little bit of a blip. And his argument is basically that if you take a step back and you take a look at the console industry, it's just extremely unlikely that this particular industry is going to suddenly out of nowhere spike to a point where, you know, it's as ubiquitous as mobile phones. You know, versus say the adoption of a TV itself, versus the versus the adoption of other mediums or other platforms. It's it doesn't look very good if you take a look at it in that way. So I think that's interesting. I think that's why a lot of people feel that maybe this is like the last generation of consoles. I'm less sure because geez, there's a lot of interest. it might be small, but it is still growing. And the real problem is that you're still not replicating these experiences elsewhere. You're not going to your iPhone and playing The Last of Us. That's just, you know, that's not, that those types of experiences are not available. And I think it's unlikely that, you know, the phone and the tablet will just sort of take over that space. There's so many fundamental issues, not the least of which is input method. You know, you still, for as great as touchscreens are, you know, and what they've enabled, we haven't seen a whole lot of leveraging of that input method to create experiences that are at a level of what you see with console games. And I think,
because what you see mostly with iOS games is there aren't too many that really take advantage of the touch input and the accelerometer and all the other controls that you can have on the device. Instead, developers are just going, well, we can't figure this out. Let's just put on-screen buttons, on-screen controls on there, so you're forever controlling with a virtual joystick, or, you know, you got two arrow things and here's the button that you press to fire or something like that. I mean, probably one of the few areas that they are really taking a bit more advantage of the hardware is racing games, because you can turn the actual device back and forth to steer. But that's kind of really the only area where they're taking advantage of with the inputs that the device already has. So that's why Apple is, they've opened it up to, well, look, now we can have third-party controllers that will either connect via the Lightning port or via Bluetooth.
Yeah, a couple things there. So one, you're talking about like racing games and the fact that that's one thing that kind of takes advantage of it. One of the things that never comes up, though, when people bring that one up is the fact that, so like if you're holding an iPad and you're playing Ridge Racer or you know, whatever the latest Game Loft rip-off racing game is, there's like a level of like fatigue there where you're like holding up this device and turning it. So you're not, again, the experience is fundamentally kind of different because you're not going to spend hours and hours and hours doing this, are you? You know,
no.
So that to me is interesting. And then let's see, what was the other thing though that you mentioned? I don't know. So the other, oh yeah, that's right. So the other interesting thing about like what's going on with iOS games is that you see lots and lots of ports of like old games. And
yeah, Rockstar recently brought out, I think it was GTA San Andreas for iOS and Android.
Yeah, and this is something that I've talked about frequently on the menu bar, but like the fact that it feels like a lot of game developers are maybe drawing the wrong conclusions about what the market is for, you know, for mobile games, mobile game experiences. So you'd think that this far into the lifespan of iOS, you'd have, you know, maybe like one of these big game developers, you know, or publishers looking at this platform and saying, we could probably make, you know, as much if not more money here than we make in the console business. Like, why don't we make the next Grand Theft Auto on iOS? You know, why don't we make the next Final Fantasy on iOS? But that's not what you're seeing. Instead, what you're seeing is endless ports of old games, sort of being, you know, not very well ported, if we're being honest. Like, they're on screen.
Well, the input method is that's the biggest hurdle,
right? So you're frankly just not seeing a whole lot of imagination there. And I don't I don't think it's a problem fundamentally of input method. I really think it's fundamentally a problem of sort of drawing the wrong conclusions from the market by using the minimum viable product as a proxy to understand what the market is. I think that they put out all these ports to kind of see what, you know, initially they wanted to see what is the interest level in these kinds of games? And they think, you know, what they saw is that it's profitable, but it's not as profitable as, you know, the situation that they've got going on with consoles. So it's still not quite viable. They don't think it's quite viable to say release the next big Grand Theft Auto game as a thing that takes 100% advantage of touch controls, you know. And there's not a whole lot of creativity happening there. So there's a lot of different theories as to what's going on there. A lot of people think that it's just not possible with touch input. I'm skeptical of that because I don't think it's a problem of touch input.
I think that there's a touch input offers a lot of possibilities. It's just that we're not really searching for them. You know, we're just happy to go with the on-screen controls, and you know that's it. So people really need to at what input it has, and then what experience can we get from this? That's something unique, something different. I think that's the track that people need to head down.
Yeah, and so in a lot of what you see on iOS sort of comes from independent game developers, and a lot of the really original experiences have come from independent game developers. The things that really sort of take, you know, like Sword and Sorcery and that sort of thing, that have really sort of taken advantage of the platform, or Waking Mars also comes to mind. But the problem is that there's only so far that an indie game developer can go, right? You're still not going to see, again, something like at the level of The Last of Us on iOS. The only ones who can kind of pull something that big off are the big players, and the big players, again, I think maybe have drawn the wrong conclusions about what the market is capable of sustaining. Whereas I think if they were to really go full force and, you know, really take advantage of touch controls and say, you know, release a $30 game, maybe, you know, a sequel to an actual sequel to one of their big franchises, I bet that would be huge. I bet they make just as much money, if not more money, you know, on that platform. But we're just not seeing that yet. So, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for why, not the least of which is the fact that everybody's kind of comfortable with how things are. You know, the fact that GameStop as a business still exists, you know, it sort of says a lot. I think that, yeah, it really comes down to they're used to the way that the retail experience works on the console side. They're used to a certain, you know, profit margin. They're used to selling things in a certain way. So I think that's just, you still see the big publishers sort of gravitating around those platforms, and they see mobile as, you know, this opportunity to just sort of create these free games that have endless in-app purchasing, and it's all just profit.
Yeah.
And it's a really sad state of affairs if you think about it.
It is.
So, you know, I don't know. And I think so what's going to change that, I think, would be a lot of things that, again, just don't exist yet. Game controllers for iOS, isn't it? You know, the stuff that we've seen early on with regards to game controllers, with, you know, say the new controllers that have been released just for iOS 7, they're not very good, and they're kind of expensive, and they don't really take advantage of that many games. I think it's just sort of approaching the entire problem all wrong.
Because it's trying to replicate what we already have, when what we should be doing is building something entirely new.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that Apple maybe, it's hard to get into this, but I think that the what maybe Apple should have concentrated on instead of opening up MiFi controllers is maybe improving Game Center and you know, taking a look at, so what are the successful things, you know, in online gaming, and what could, you know, people always complain about Game Center. We have, you know, probably thousands and thousands of complaints about Game Center alone. So what can we do there? And that's not what they did. For some reason, they decided to open up these MiFi controllers. I really have a question mark in my mind. It's like, why did they do this at all? Because I'm interested in those controllers as a total nerd, right? But like,
yeah,
these things are not going to become mainstream products, you know. And thinking,
no, because of their expense and because of the, you know, because for a developer to, I don't know how hard or easy it is to implement that stuff, but developers have to implement it to begin with. Yeah. And they're only going to do that when there's enough people out there with the controllers to make it worthwhile for them to spend that effort and energy doing that. So it's very niche at the moment. I think it will probably stay that way, to be honest.
And then you have this other problem, which is that all the really, really great experiences in iOS kind of don't need a controller, right? Yeah. So like those are the ones that don't have the problem. And all the games that would benefit from a, you know, controller, they're mostly like old ports. So it's like it's a niche, you know, market that's possible there. You're never going to see a situation where I think like millions of people go out and buy a controller for their iPad so they can play, you know, GTA or whatever on their iPad. That's sort of a hacky thing to do. I would do it in a heartbeat, but I'm not most people, you know. So I think it's kind of the wrong approach. You know, initially when they did that whole thing, I thought maybe, maybe this somehow ties into the Apple TV. Maybe what they're doing is they're sort of seeding the market with controllers for iOS, and these things will also maybe work with a new box that they release. Because that would be interesting, and then you'd have a situation where automatically off the bat, you'd have all these games that were immediately compatible with the Apple TV. And maybe that's still part of why they did it at all. Because, you know, Apple is a company that doesn't tend to do things without some sort of reason. So it's just random that they decided to put this support in there. Like they just randomly throw a bone to people who are asking for it. It's just strange, you know?
Yeah, it's an interesting move, and I'd like to see where it goes. And I kind of do wonder about the Apple TV has been, you know, playing games on that, because a lot of people have already used AirPlay to, you know, we'll use the iPhone as a controller and we'll play it up on the big screen.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's latency issues there. So you sort of wonder if, will the Apple TV be able to play games natively, and how will they, Apple go about, you know, making that happen?
It's frustrating because it's all guesswork. So, you know, what's the most ideal way to get, for Apple to get games into the living room? Well, it would be to add storage to the currently existing Apple TV. But then that would be completely different than what we see in their current strategy, which is they release this little box with 8 gigabytes of storage, but you can't do anything with that storage. It's just all sort of sitting there for caching movies and that sort of thing. What if they open up an app store? There's just a lot of fundamental problems. They'd have to you'd have to see a completely different kind of strategy from them in the TV space, in order to make any of this sort of theoretical stuff viable. It's something that we've all kind of thought they're going to do eventually, but they haven't done it. And you have just these random things like that. Here they are opening up controller support, you know, for iOS. And for me, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, unless if there's some sort of TV component down the road. Here we are just sort of waiting to see what they do. Another option they could go down, which has occurred to me, is rather than going the AirPlay route and rather than going the native route, is they could do something kind of like Gaikai, where they're actually streaming stuff to you. But then you have another problem, which is that not everybody has, you know, that great access to the internet.
No.
So buffering games doesn't seem like a great option either. So, I mean, it's full of question marks still. Yeah, and every time I think that I might have some vague idea of where they might be headed, you know, they don't do anything. So it's, you know, and I honestly think that if they have really big plans in the TV space, games are kind of like maybe the least of their concerns. I think that what's holding that up more than anything is trying to because movies is, you know, video content is a bit much, you know, inarguably a bigger market than games, period.
Yeah.
Like, so their primary concern with the TV space is going to be video content and trying to figure out what are we going to do there. Are we going to integrate with cable? Are we going to offer our own subscription service? Or are we just going to enable, you know, lots of different segmentation, you know, the way that we sort of have with iOS? There's sort of all these question marks surrounding video. And then, lots of hesitancy on the part of all the big, players in, Hollywood, TV, to make deals with Apple with regards to all of that. So I think that's what's holding it up more than anything. As for games, I think that the way that they probably see it is like, you know, all we need to do is open it and it's done.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Apple's never had a great interest in games. And I kind of think with iOS, they stumbled dick first into success because they made something that it was reasonably powerful graphically. It had a novel input thing, and people were just really excited about the prospect of developing apps for it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people looked at it and thought that that'd be such a great mobile gaming device. I think it really caught them by surprise, the amount of games that were on there and the amount of success that games were having on the platform.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they see it as a situation where they don't need to do anything with it. For them, what they need to do is enable the opportunity for software to exist. But games specifically is not something that they need to put a whole lot of effort into. I mean, so if they release an Apple TV that's gotten, you know, native support to play games, all they need to do is say, hey, this is here, and suddenly you have, you know, thousands and thousands of developers making stuff for it. So it's really not a problem. That's what sort of makes the idea of an Apple TV that can play games so interesting with regards to the console space, because, you know, looking at what they've done with mobile and seeing the amount of revenue that's generated out of games on mobile, it just, you know, it feels like, is there even room for consoles in a space where Apple just opens it up, frankly? That might be enough to sort of massively take away from console sales.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest benefit about having the Apple TV open to games would be that now indie developers would have another avenue to be able to sell their games and potentially be more successful, because I have heard complaints about indie developers having difficulties getting titles onto Xbox Live, and there's all sorts of horrible things that go into that, where, you know, there's timed exclusivity, getting things onto Xbox Live, you know, it has to be on Xbox first, and then after a period of time you can release it on everywhere else, and it kind of turns into a nightmare. But whereas the App Store, it's by comparison, it's a lot simpler, because you make your thing, you submit it to Apple, they review it, hopefully it gets approved, and then boom, it's out in the store, ready to go, and people can buy it. You know, it's a lot simpler process. So I sort of see that as that would be a great opportunity for independent developers to really get their ideas out there and actually make some money off of them.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's so difficult to talk about because there's no evidence that they're actually doing this anytime soon. But I completely agree that would be huge for them to enable this. It's just a matter of, and I don't even think it's a matter of if. I think it's just a matter of when. You know, they will eventually circle around to this. How much will they care about it? I don't know. That's sort of the interesting bit. I often wonder like how much does Apple care about games? You'd think increasingly quite a bit given the dynamics in the App Store, but then you look at Game Center and they clearly kind of don't. So it's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, the Game Center is almost a me too sort of thing. You know, they looked at Xbox Live and Steam and
right. Well, and in the case of
we've got to have our own thing.
Yeah, and in the case of iOS 7, it's basically just like, hey, here's a demo of iOS 7 animations. Like, you know, they're like, well, no one opens this app anyway. We'll throw all the
we'll use it for a tech demo.
We'll use it for a tech demo to show to the developers what you could do with animations. Yeah, it's. I mean, I really, you look at it, that's really what it looks like. It's very weird because yeah. It actually takes longer to open now, and it's less pleasant.
I don't think I've ever opened Game Center on iOS 7.
It's not a pleasant experience, especially on anything like slightly older, because it's weirdly their most animation intensive app. It doesn't make any sense. I totally don't understand what they were thinking there. Again, I think for Apple, they just see it as a software issue where, again, they just need to enable the opportunity for developers to go in and do what they want. They don't see it as something where they need to do a whole lot. And, you know, looking at the evidence, I can see where they'd come to that conclusion. I wonder.
I just opened Game Center now. That took a long time before it displayed anything on the screen. And it's just, yeah, there's bubbles wiggling around, and you go,
yeah,
this is kind of pointless.
It's terrible. So actually, one thing I want to throw out there for the heck of it, just because it's something that I've thought about, is circling back to Nintendo. I think, interestingly enough, that like, so given the way that we've seen Apple enter the games market, which is sort of by not caring but enabling lots of opportunity, what would be interesting about an Apple TV is that it could actually be a situation where a company like Nintendo might feel comfortable. And the reason for that, I think, is because I don't think if Apple gets into this space that they're going to release their own controllers. I think that if this MiFi controller stuff indicates anything, it's that they might, their strategy might be, what if basically there is no primary input method? What if we just enable all of the accessories under the sun to be able to play games with? And suddenly Nintendo is still making hardware, you know, and then maybe developing games on a different platform. But they could still enable new input methods. They could still innovate, you know, in that area.
And it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, something I've thought a lot about, you know, with regards to wearable computing and all these things that are sort of coming down the pike, is that what we're kind of seeing is the same dynamics in consumer electronics as we saw with apps, where there's like these accessories, which I think that could potentially be very interesting with regards to games, because games, there's so many games now that require like their own specific hardware. You know, maybe with a first person shooter, you kind of want a keyboard and mouse, or maybe with a rhythm game or something like that. Maybe you want an actual guitar or a set of drums. And so with something like the Apple TV, maybe there's no one primary input method. Maybe there's kind of a generic controller spec for most games. But outside of that, you know, the sky's sort of the limit. And, you know, accessory makers can make whatever the hell they want. You know, maybe you might even see a situation where some game developers get into the game of making their own hardware. I mean, Valve is now currently experimenting with building their own controllers and their own game consoles.
Yeah.
And so that's where that actually gets interesting. And I think that might be the sort of thing where no one's really focusing that intensely on it. But I think that might be where we're going to see the massive change in games, is I think that, you know, we're all looking for the next big input method. What if the next big input method is every input method, and it's enabled, through the hub of, you know, these devices, you know, that just sort of enable opportunity for all kinds of different experiences. So I don't know. That's a thought that's occurred to me on more than one occasion.
Yeah, and that's something that I'd like to see. Just to have that box, and you know, it has all these different experiences because, you know, you can get different hardware for it, and it all just works. You know, just one sort of communication standard that all of these things rely on, and yeah, the hardware manufacturer, they just go, okay, well, you know, we'll just support whatever spec, and off we go. You know,
yeah,
that sounds incredibly interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. That's just my hunch, but I sense that that's where things are going. One problem I see with like if Apple enters this space is, so with phones, they can kind of upgrade every year, and
yeah,
you know, and that works out. And maybe with something like a $99 Apple TV box, they could maybe get away with that.
Yeah, if you were talking of like performance increases double every year, I think they probably could get away with that.
Yeah, but it's something that's completely untested. We've never seen a product that you hook up to your TV that people sort of consider disposable year to year. Disposable enough to where, like, you know, I'm gonna get a new one every year, you know? So I still think it's like a fundamental, almost like psychology problem. If it's hooked up to your TV, it's sort of a box. It's just going to sit there and it's good and it's done. So, you know, where Apple would want to make its money is either in services or in, you know, in taking a cut from development for it. So yeah, I don't know. It's one of these things. I think there's a lot of fantasies out there about what they'll do. But I have seen very little critical thinking about it, I guess. It's sort of the general consensus that you see is well, they'll just enable apps and they're done and they'll be good. But there's a lot of issues surrounding this from Apple's point of view. Like why on earth is that even a space that they want to get into? Boxes that you put in, you know, under your TV are not things that people replace often enough for it to be compelling from a profit point of view. So I immediately wonder what sort of incentive do they give people to that, you know, that they're going to be making enough money for this to be something that they, you know, that they want to do? So I don't know. Lots of question marks.
Yeah. Yeah, and talking about the you know, analysis, and like, there's over the years have been so many people saying, oh, you know, Apple build their own TV or
right.
get into gaming and things like that. And there's never really much thought put into it beyond just scratching the surface.
Yeah, and you know what happens is Apple goes and does that thing, but it's totally oblique from what the expectation was. I mean, even just something as simple as, okay, well, Apple's going to release a smaller iPad. But everyone got the price wrong, and everyone got sort of the positioning wrong. So, like, even when Apple goes and does the very thing that everyone expects them to do, it's in a way that's not quite what you expected. So, you know, and that's why I try to do some sort of out of the box thinking about something like a TV product. It's not gonna be straight, you know, the straightforward idea that we have in our heads, which is like, oh, they'll just release a TV. You know, but no, they won't.
Oh, how hard could it be? They just make a TV. Like, people do it all the time.
Right. And, you know, well, they'll just get into the same space that everyone else is in. And you have people upgrade their TV every 4 to 10 years. No, Apple doesn't want anything to do with that. And not just that, like, it just doesn't change anything, really. Again, that's where it gets interesting. Like, so let's say Apple was building a TV. What would make that a compelling product? It would probably be something like input method. And that's where I see, you know, but they're not going to do that because you can't just upgrade the input method in your TV like every few years. So
no.
So I think that whatever they're going to do is some kind of box. That probably in itself enables other hardware or enables other connected devices. I think that that's got to be the central strategy.
Yeah, I like that idea. You brought up Valve and their Steam machines.
Yeah.
That's all in beta at the moment, and that's a. I think it's a very interesting move that the Valve is kind of trying to become masters of their own destiny in with hardware, because at the moment they're on Windows and OS X and on Linux, but they weren't happy about the moves that Microsoft made with Windows 8. It sort of damaged their position slightly. So I think now they're trying to move out and be less dependent on other companies. So that's why they're getting into their own hardware space and their own, you know, forked version of Linux, and they're doing it, you know, making their own operating system and hoping that developers get on board and develop games for it. And there's been a lot of games have been ported to Linux, so I think they'll be pretty successful with that. And you look at where they're positioning it, they're not positioning it as this is a PC, a gaming PC that you sit on your desk and with a keyboard and mouse. No, this is a box that is standardized, there's different price points to it, anyone can make a spec, and you hook it up to your TV and you interact with a controller. So they're trying to get into that console space, which is a lot of people are console gamers just because it's easier, and you can walk into a shop, buy the console, and all that you need to do to make sure that the games run is just pick up the game with the right label on the top. You know, yes, this is an Xbox game, I can play it on my Xbox, no worries. So they're trying to, Valve is trying to move into that space where, you know, it's a lot more accessible to more customers out there. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with Steam machines down the track. And I mean, when they brought out the controller in the first point, it had the touch screen in the middle, and they didn't really fully explain what that was for, and it wasn't even available on the prototypes that they've sent out to people. It was just this blank space, and one day a touchscreen will be here.
Right.
Lord knows what you're going to do with it.
Right.
And now they've actually removed that touchscreen entirely and reconfigured the button layout. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with that.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that. Like, so I think it's very smart what they're doing, because they're kind of going out there and with this sort of spec for what a Steam box should be, and they're taking very little risk on their own. You know,
they're letting everyone else do all the hard work. Really.
But you can see, like, that makes sense from a lot of different angles. So vendors are pissed off at Microsoft for all kinds of reasons, you know, having to do with Windows 8 and its performance and all these different things. And
yeah, and Windows Microsoft making hardware now, you know, they're doing the Surface and Surface 2, so that's sort of I'm sure that stirred the waters a bit.
Yeah, so the time is sort of ripe for maybe alternative platforms to be able to gain some traction, and targeting gamers specifically is interesting, because you know, gamers are the early adopters. They're the people who go out and buy the latest graphics card, and you know, they're the reason why so much research and development is able to be done in those spaces to be able to get that stuff eventually cheaper, and then, you know, all the way down to things like mobile. So that's an interesting strategy that they have, and I think I don't know how successful it will be in and of itself. There's lots of, again, sort of fundamental problems with it, which not the least of which is like how many developers are actually going to port their games over
and how many developers are going to do, okay, well, first party titles on Steam, you know, it's instead of ports, you know, where they develop first for the Steam OS and then they port it to other things afterwards, you know, how many people are going to be on board with that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that they will have some traction, just because Valve is such a big deal. One thing I like about Valve's approach is they're trying to inspire the industry to do more. Right? This isn't merely about making money. You know, obviously they want to survive, but the reason you want to survive is so that you can continue to change things and make cool games and all that stuff. So they're just trying to figure out, you know, how can we how can we survive, you know, going forward? Obviously, we can't just release Steam for iOS. You know, it's not possible. It's not viable to our business strategy. And it wouldn't even be a great experience, even if it was possible. So, you know, I think it's an interesting plan. And it'll be, I have absolutely no solid prediction as to like whether or not that's going to be successful. But, you know, inside of the whole thing, I think that there's a trend there. I think there's a, there's some hints about where gaming is going, period. And again, it sort of ties back into what I was saying about the Apple TV as being something that could maybe enable not just one input method. The Steam Box is something else that could very much do the same thing. You know, they've got that controller spec, but from what I understand, you can connect anything to a Steam Box because fundamentally it's basically just a PC. So anything that anything where the drivers are written for it will work. So
yes, they've designed this thing from the start to be that anyone can do basically whatever they want with it. You can swap all the parts out. You can make modifications to the operating system. I mean, it's running on goddamn Linux. So
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of possibility there with what you can do aftermarket wise. No.
So I mean, I see that as both its greatest strength and its potentially greatest weakness. So they have. It's sort of like the you know Wild Wild West. So you can do anything you want with it, but because you can do anything you want with it, I think that you're going to see a lot of very varying products from different vendors, and I think that you're going to see different people try to do very different things. You may end up just with a situation where this is really just for not even hardcore gamers, but maybe a niche of hardcore gamers, and never any penetration with, you know, regular people. So yeah, I mean, and it comes back to this question of game consoles as being something that can eventually penetrate to a much wider audience than currently exists. And I don't know if the Steam Box is the thing that is going to be able to do that. I think more likely something that enables, you know, a multitude of different experiences, not just games alone. I think that's the thing that would probably be able to do that. And we're not just talking about like Candy Crush Saga on your TV here. Like hopefully it'd be something more than
that. Yes, hopefully. John's complained about Candy Crush on this podcast many, many times.
I'm sure it's a terrible thing that's happened to a certain segment of games, but
yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. Like, I think games are a very interesting thing that a lot of people who are in developing apps and software and looking at that kind of thing, I think there's a few things that we're not 100% appreciating, which is like, so you look at like iOS 7. I'm kind of diverging here, but this is something interesting that just occurred to me. So like, you look at iOS 7 and the fact that now this operating system is taking like really full advantage of the GPU. And now you're getting things like interaction design and all these animations and all these different transparency layers and that sort of thing. Like, this is something that you typically used to see in, you know, games. And now we're seeing it at the core software layer of just the base operating system and apps. And I think there might be something interesting there. I think there might be a thread that I don't really know what this means, but I feel like there's sort of a convergence of what we typically would think of as a game and what we would typically think as a piece of software or utility. And that's sort of interesting. And I wonder if there's also maybe there's something there. Because the question that I keep asking myself is, you know, looking at something like Horace's 100-year graph of, you know, the video game consoles as being a blip on that chart, what will eventually, you know, make games into something that changes everybody's lives? You know, like, it's something that everybody does, and it's just a totally normal part of society, you know? Like, people who intensely play World of Warcraft and that sort of thing. What's the thing that takes that to the next level, where that's just that's an everyday, you know, part of society. It's no longer just a geek thing. And so, you know, you look at the what's happening to just software, like iOS 7, you know, just at the fundamental software layer. And I don't know, it feels like there's something there. Nothing specific, just a random thought. Sort of similar to my idea about the, you know, the appification of consumer electronics eventually. Because I don't know, I think that things tend to converge and integrate, and it tends to happen in a way that we didn't quite expect. Another thing that's sort of interesting is, like, you know, in the early 90s, we were absolutely obsessed with virtual reality, right? And we kind of all thought that that would be the next step for everything. Like, eventually we're all just going to plug into these headsets and, you know, escape. And you know, that's actually where the internet would be born, and that's where all these you know, really great things would happen. But that's kind of not what happened. You sort of had the internet boom in the 90s, and then, you know, now we're all the way up to smartphones. What's interesting is that we're now currently doing all of the things that we envisioned in the early 90s with VR, but we're doing it with our phones, and we're doing it with these mobile devices, and we're doing it with the you know, interconnected, you know, it's this cliche as hell, but the Internet of Things, I guess. We're actually seeing all of that, but it didn't quite happen in the way that we expected, right? So I like to try to, you know, look at what are people predicting about the future, and then try to think, well, what will actually be the practical way that will actually end up trickling down the pike. I don't know.
the second screen stuff is that's something that's starting to gain a bit of traction at the moment, where you're playing a game at a console and you have your phone or your tablet next to you, and you can use that as a secondary input device or just something that's displaying information. I kind of look at this as a bit of an interesting space, and I hope that more developers do more things with this in the future, because, you know, every time that I'm playing GTA 5, like, I wish that I could have the map on my iPad that's connected to the game, so I can see, you know, just use that as my GPS, so I can see where I'm going and see things that are on the map, and that sort of thing. I think would just be so damn cool.
That's interesting. So, like, you know, you remember the Tamagotchi pets and the Gigapet type thing? I've always wondered, like, so when is that going to come, like back into society, where we all, like, really care about these weird things? And the second screen stuff actually sort of brings that up for me. So on one hand, you have, like, second screen stuff where you are, like, literally maybe looking at a map, you know, for GTA while you're playing the game.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's also the situation where there's some games where you can actually take, like, a piece of the game with you, say on your phone or whatever. Maybe it can even send you push notifications when your friends do something. And you maybe can handle a bit of that from your phone, and that trickles back down into the console experience. I think that is that's a very interesting thing, because we're seeing so much more inter-platform play, and then more parity with these platforms that I think that kind of thing is you know, more and more enabled as time passes.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. You know, we're seeing it with again, like World of Warcraft, and a lot of these online MMOs have things that you can do, like, outside of the core gameplay experience.
Yeah, isn't it an auction house or something like that? You can do that on your phone.
Yes. Yeah. So I think we're gonna see a lot more of that, because it's working, it's gaining traction. I think the more that we see platform parity, the more that we're going to see that sort of thing. The more that, you know, these devices become more powerful, the more it'll be about more than just being able to do like auction house stuff. Maybe there's even a situation where you can, actually enter the World of Warcraft, and you know, that's actually has some kind of parity with the core game itself, but maybe you don't go and do the battles, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a very interesting thing, and I think we're going to see lots more of that as time passes.
Yeah. One sort of crazy idea that I've had, because survival games are pretty big at the moment. I heard some comment the other day that, the top featured page on Steam, it's all survival games. There's the DayZ and Rust and all these other ones I can't quite recall at the moment. But I'm thinking, well, wouldn't it be great if, like, there was some component of that tied to your phone, and, you know, maybe what you did in the real world had some sort of impact on your character and how well they survived. I mean, imagine if, you had the Fitbit or something like that that's tracking your steps. So the more exercise that you do in the real world, it has some impact on your game character, so that when you go back into that world, you know, maybe they can run faster or run longer or something like that because of what you've done, you know. I think that'd be... It's super gimmicky, but...
Is it, though?
I think there's something interesting.
On one hand, it's very gimmicky, but it also has a direct impact on your life. Hmm. And if you can get that into, if that ever becomes a socially or culturally accepted thing, that becomes very interesting, because then you're no longer just playing a game to escape and have fun, but you're actually playing it to improve yourself, to come right back into your real life. I think that is also a very compelling idea. And I agree. I've had a lot of thoughts about wearable computing and how that could eventually tie into games. And what you said actually sums it up pretty perfectly. I totally think that'd be awesome. I can't wait for that kind of thing.
I think it would be too, but it's getting back to the Apple TV thing that I was saying before, that's just sort of the scratch the surface type stuff. I mean, I'm pretty sure that if you sat down and had a good hard think about it, you can come up with all sorts of amazing things, and very compelling things that would make that something that people want to, because, I mean, I say that just there and you go, oh, well, yeah, that's a bit gimmicky. And it doesn't sort of drive that real, it's not inspiring, it's not exciting or anything like that.
Yeah, but neither is Snapchat. Like, it's amazing, you know, and frankly, neither is, like, Facebook, if we're being honest. Like, but yet these things, and the dynamics of what, you know, the way that people actually wind up using something like Facebook... The things that are culturally acceptable are kind of crazy, if you really think about it. So, I don't know. You're right. It might be kind of a gimmick, and maybe it's not that inspiring. Maybe it actually kind of is. It really all comes down to a matter of implementation and execution. If someone can nail a way that you're really going to, you know, give a crap about doing that, I don't know. It's... That's a very interesting concept to me. This idea that you could have something like a digital avatar in a game that's directly affected by things that happen in real life. I think that's a very interesting concept. There's been experiments with this. Things like Second Life. But we haven't seen it come to sort of its like full fruition. But yeah, I think we're gonna see more and more of that. It's just sort of it doesn't just make sense from a like a gameplay point of view, but it makes sense from a like a hard business point of view. Like, there's just so much opportunity for how you can charge people for services that enable that sort of thing, and then you get into advertising. I mean, I'm not arguing this is good or bad. I'm just saying.
These are the possibilities.
These are the possibilities, and if you think about it, it feels kind of inevitable. Like, of course these things are going to happen. It's just a matter of when and how will that really look. I mean, even, you know, and Google is experimenting with these kinds of things with Ingress, that game for Android, where I believe the whole game is pretty much like an augmented reality game, where you're actually having to go and do tasks in real life in order to play this game. So, and from what I understand, that's a fairly popular game. I haven't played it myself, because it seems too involved. But yeah, I think we're going to see lots more of that sort of thing. You know, and Snapchat integration into first-person shooters will somehow somehow occur.
Actually, in GTA, like, you can, because your character has their own phone, and there's a camera app on there. So I quite enjoy, like, when I see something happen, I'll take a photo of it so I can post it online and
you know, so show people. So weird.
Yeah.
Like, I bet 10 years ago you wouldn't have, like, imagined that taking a photo in a game and sharing it with your friends would be something that you'd be interested in doing. Yeah. But suddenly, now that it's this option, like, you're like, oh, this is kind of cool. I'll do it.
Yeah. I see something happen. I'm like, I'll take a photo of that.
Right. Well, here's another thing. So, like, Twitch TV, like, this whole thing, this whole phenomenon, a really big and growing phenomenon of just watching someone play a game.
Yeah, it's fascinating, like how that space has developed. You know, the amount of people out there doing Let's Plays is just phenomenal.
I mean, and I personally think it's crazy, but clearly that type of stuff, it's pulling a thread and people are very much responding to it.
Yeah. I think we have this innate need to sort of share experiences with people. So I think that, because gaming, like we talked about, you know, playing the Super Nintendo out in the lounge room earlier, where you know, other people are watching you play, but gaming, it can sort of become like a very personal, individual thing, where there's, you know, there's nobody else around watching you or something like that, but you still want to share that experience with other people. So I think that's what's driving that thing where we're all recording our own footage and posting it online. And it's especially prevalent in a game like DayZ or GTA, where the experience that you have is going to be very different to the experience that everyone else has, because nothing's scripted. Things just happen.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, ripe for sharing.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very interesting way to think about the whole thing. Yeah, I don't know. I think, given the dynamics that we've seen with social networking and, you know, everything from Facebook to Twitter to whatever. Again, this is where I come back to this whole convergence idea, where you know, the lines really blur between what a game is and something like Twitter is. I mean, it's interesting because something like Twitter, you know, what you're doing is it's really just a means to communicate or to tell a story about yourself. And I think that, you know, we think about things like augmented reality. I feel like games are heading more and more in the direction of becoming things that enable, you know, augmenting reality and making reality cooler than it already is, I guess.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's just so much opportunity for how you could learn and grow as a person via the proxy of a game. You know, and how that could integrate with real life. So I think, you know, and a company like Apple might actually be interested in that kind of game, you know, down the road, like this, something that's really going to have a direct impact on your life, you know.
So I brought up DayZ earlier, and I kind of want to talk about online gaming and multiplayer, and traditionally, for me, playing online has been something that I'm just not interested in. Like, I don't want to play with other people. I don't want to play against other people. But the thing with DayZ, it's actually prompted me to go out and get my friend to build me a gaming PC so that I can get on there and play with other people. And the big driving thing behind that is the experiences that you can have playing that game with other people. It's just completely unlike any other game, because it's not just, you know, getting on a deathmatch in an FPS and or something like that, where it's really competitive and your only motive is just to kill other people. But what you actually find with DayZ is that there are people who actually help each other in the game. You know, not everyone is out to be a jerk and, you know, kill you by force-feeding you detergent or something like that. There are actually people in the game that they role-play as doctors. You know, so they have a place where they are in the map, and they have all these medical supplies, and you can message them on a forum somewhere, and tell them where you are and what you need, and they will go out there and help you. There's all sorts of just amazing experiences that you can have in that game that you just don't have other in other places, and it's kind of like a Journey. You know, that's another game where it has the online component, but it's not about being competitive and anything like that. It's about helping others, you know. So I kind of look at online multiplayer, and I do like the competitive scene of it, but I hope that it's things start shifting in that direction where it's not about killing each other. It's about doing something a bit more constructive than that.
Yeah, I think that the there's something to be said for the idea that the design of something can encourage, you know, encourage certain sorts of behavior. So it's like it's not really surprising if you think about it that there's so many jerks on World of Warcraft, that there's so many jerks on Call of Duty, and that these are the people who are, you know, the most popular players in a lot of instances. Like these are the best people at those games. So I think, you know, that when you see different kinds of gameplay ideas thrown into the mix, like, you know, if something is more or less just about survival, and you have, you know, one of the things you can do is be a doctor, that's a very interesting thing too. We definitely need more games that are, you know, thinking outside the box about what a game can be, another game I would bring up is something like Flower, where, you know, I have on my Vita, which is basically this game where you are sort of floating through the wind. You know, these leaves are floating through the wind. You basically are the wind, and you're picking up, you know, picking things up and sort of doing this godlike gardening. I don't know, you know, and that's really what you're doing. But you could spend hours doing it. It's just a lot of fun. You're not killing anything at all. And the way that you lose is, well, you know, you lose momentum. And that's not, it's fundamentally a very different kind of experience from these other kinds of games. So, yeah, I think there's a lot more that can be done with games than just, you know, playing to be the best or playing to win. I think that's a by design kind of thing. I think we're seeing that more and more. I think we're seeing a lot of tons of articles get written every year about, you know, the opportunities lost in gaming and the things that can be done with gameplay. Like, it doesn't need to just be a first person shooter. We're going around shooting people. I mean, this came up with what was it? BioShock Infinite. The fact that you know, like, everyone was sort of blown away by it. But then there was sort of this other group of people that kind of said, yeah, but I'm kind of just going around and shooting people in the head and watching cinematics occur as a result.
Well, that's one component of the game.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, it still comes back to that, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that that's, like, the one, you know, maybe the fundamental thing that drives the gameplay forward is you're still going around shooting people. And you have to, right? But you can imagine all kinds of games, all kinds of scenarios where a game might encourage completely different ideas. You know, one of the reasons why Metal Gear Solid is one of my favorite games of all time is because it was so different at the time, in that you could get through pretty much the entire game, not all of it, but pretty much, by, you know, avoiding killing anybody. Stealth game.
Yeah, it's the same thing with Crysis, because I've played Crysis 2, where I've gone all stealth, and I only kill people when I'm required to.
Yeah.
It's just a totally different experience to be just sneaking around and just avoiding everyone. And you get through the game, and you just, okay, so for the entire game, I killed three dudes. And you just, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and I bet that, like, really changes their psychology about it. Like, so...
Yeah, it does.
The moment that you realize, oh, shit, I've got to kill somebody. Like, suddenly that's a profound moment. Because it's a rare instance in the game. So it's more realistic, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
So I agree. That's it's very interesting. I think, you know, we're definitely seeing more and more games like that, particularly out of the indie community, but I think it's also, you know, happening with bigger and bigger games. So that's a good trend, I think. And again, ties very directly in with all of the other things that we've discussed so far.
So one thing that we want to talk about on the show is, like, we've talked about how the hardware might change in the future and how the companies change and how games themselves might change. But one thing that I'd like to look at is how gamers themselves might change.
What are your first thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts on this are that when you look at it, because gaming is only very, very recent, you know, within the last 20, 30 years, you look at the people who have grown up with games, they're now introducing that to their children. So there's this whole new generation of people growing up with games. It's just games just being a part of their life. And unfortunately, it's gaming is sort of, there's a section of the community that wants to claim gaming as a male-only thing. This is a male-only pastime, and what I'm hoping is going forward that as more people are being introduced to games, as more people are playing games, this will diversify the community so that we have lots and lots of different people playing games, and hopefully make the community a safer place to be. I mean, because talking about online multiplayer before, one of the reasons that I don't get on an FPS and play against other people is because I don't want to be yelled at by some uncouth 12-year-old in Texas, as you keep saying, calling me a noob and having to go at how well I can play the game, and
yeah,
you know, that's not fun for anyone. So,
well, it's so much worse if you're a woman, and you know, and if you are on a mic, you know, and people know, oh, this is actually a girl, you know,
yeah,
you get harassed in ways that you wouldn't believe if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, I've heard stories where everyone else in the game will actively turn on you.
Yeah,
if you're a woman, and it's you know, they could be playing just as well as everyone else. They could, it just doesn't matter. It's like you're the opposite gender to us, so therefore we must attack you. It's horrible.
Yeah, and it doesn't happen in every community, but it's predominant. Put it that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think gamers are going to have to grow up, and I think that'll happen as games themselves grow up. Again, as we see sort of these changes in how you think about gameplay, I think you'll see changes in the kinds of people that are attracted to games. You know, something that's not really brought up in the entire sort of sexism in gaming debate is the fact that there are and I don't mean this in any negative way at all. I think it's absolutely, you know, fantastic. But there are now more women being, you know, who want to play games, right?
Yeah.
And I think the reason for that is because gaming is becoming a more compelling thing for more people. It's not just women, but, you know, all sorts of people that would not have otherwise been interested in games are now drawn to it. And I think that's natural because, like you said, it's still kind of in its infancy, and compared to where it could go. And like I've been saying, it's still, you know, if you take all of the gamers worldwide and add them up, and it's still not, you know, it's still not anything like, you know, the amount of people adopting phones, you know. So you what you want is eventually you'd think that you know, everybody will play some kind of game in one way or the other. And I think the way that it'll happen is, you know, through the design of the games and how they're implemented. And I think that, like, so the future of gamers, I think that the future of gamers is that everybody will be a gamer at some point. Which would mean that when you look at gaming today and see the sorts of people that are playing games or the sort of dynamics that play out, I think that we'll look back in 10 years or maybe 20 years and like laugh at the way that used to be. You know, yeah. Right now, I think there's almost sort of like a civil rights movement happening in gaming, you know?
Yeah, there kind of is, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's not... I'm trying to think how I want to put this, but like, so I think that because gaming has, you know, again, sort of in its infancy, and we haven't really explored that many territories yet for what gaming can be. I feel like it's a sort of a complexity thing. So as things move from like less complex to more complex over time, you know, you get things like increased care. You know, you can look at this in like developmental stages of a human being, you know. So yeah. So you start out as, you know, sort of archaic, and you don't really know anything, but as you grow up and you move through, you know, basic stages of development, you begin to care more. You begin to have more empathy. And I feel like gaming itself is becoming, as it sort of develops and grows, I think it's becoming a you know, more empathetic. I don't want to say that gaming has autonomy. I'm not going that crazy, but I'm saying that the culture of gaming is growing up.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that as that happens, you're going to see gamers change along with the times. You know, whether voluntarily or just, you know, eventually the old gamers will die and the new ones will be born.
Yeah.
And you're going to see more and more people interested in playing games, and I think that'll be as a result of things like, you know, input methods becoming more accessible, types of gameplay becoming more and more accessible, and again maybe having a direct impact on your learning or your growth, or maybe even your job someday might be gamified in some way. So, you know, and hopefully not. Not just like, you know, whoever gets the most kills gets to be CEO. Hopefully, not quite what I mean, but
yeah, that would not be a good kind of decision for a company to make.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure that's how Microsoft works, but that's maybe a topic for another day. But yeah, I think we're moving in a more positive direction. Lots of work to be done, though. Things really kind of...
Yeah, absolutely.
Things
yeah.
really suck today.
Yeah, I hope that in the future, gaming will just be... It'll be more accessible to everyone. There'll be more opportunities for people to just enjoy it. You know, because I really would like to see those negative experiences go away.
I think the way it'll actually probably play out is in parallel to, you know, how people are. Basically. So,
yeah.
You know, there will always be lowest common denominator, but what you'd hope is that there'd be opportunity to be able to do anything that you want. And that will include experiences that go beyond just playing to win and playing for the most kills and that sort of thing. You know, it'll eventually have a more direct impact on, you know, learning is something that I think a lot about. And how maybe that can eventually be applied to things like education. You know, more and more studies keep coming out that you know, kids who play lots of games and like actually finish them and are actually really good at those games tend to get pretty good grades and tend to, you know, tend to actually be very, very intelligent. You know, it's a kind of intelligence, and it's a kind of thing where you're working certain mental, you know, muscles. And more we're finding that it's not just a waste of time. It actually helps you with things like, you know, problem solving, and maybe hopefully eventually things like learning how to empathize, you know, so that becomes very, very compelling too, down the road.
Yeah. Cause I would like to see, you know, games be used in education, and I don't mean like the current state of educational games where the kind of crappy, and I mean, the games that I had when I was a kid that were educational, it's like, oh crap, now we've got to play some educational game. I'm not going to have any fun.
Yeah.
You know, it needs to be something where learning is put, you can just learn things by happenstance in the game. I can't recall the name of the game right now, but there was some RTS, whether it was Civilization or something like that, where, you know, there's actually this huge library of information, of real world information and history in there that is just there. If you're curious, you can look it up while you're playing the game, you know, so that sort of things where, you know, things where that sort of the real world can inform the game,
yeah,
and you can actually learn from it.
Yeah, and well, and games have something that a book or even a movie can't really have, which is this psychological component. And
yeah,
I think that we're going to see more of that too. I think you know, you can imagine a scenario where you're learning about the Holocaust, and maybe there's a game where you have to assume the role of a doctor in the Holocaust. Maybe you have to assume the role of a Nazi. Maybe you have to assume the role, you know, of a Jew, you know, hiding, or maybe someone who's trying to protect someone else. And maybe that's the goal of the game. That would be very
An idea like that. I mean, you suggest that, and I know that there'd be a lot of pushback from that, because the, you know, people think of, oh, the Holocaust, that's something that you've got to treat with dignity and things like that. But I think, like, imagine a first-person game where you're doing that, because I find first-person games, like, because you're being put into somebody else's body, into someone else's shoes, you're experiencing things through their eyes.
Right.
It makes it so much more confronting. So that could be like a really great learning experience. You know, imagine the lessons that you could take away from that.
Yeah, and then you get into things like what Oculus Rift and things along those lines could eventually enable, where it's just, you know, full immersion into a world. I think there's huge barriers to entry in terms of like trying to get something like that into education, like.
Oh yeah.
Oh, what did you learn today at school? Oh, I assumed the role of a Nazi to better understand what that point of view is in the Holocaust.
Yeah, that'd go down well.
No, I mean, so like, I think mankind has a little ways to go before we can do that kind of role assuming. You know, but you know, I think you'll see that stuff in maybe it'll start out in fringe education, but eventually it'll trickle down to all education, because there's just inherent value in being able to experience things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to experience. And you know,
it just helps your understanding of the world so much.
Yeah, and importantly, you're able to do it in a way that's more or less safe, you know. So it's
Because I sometimes look at GTA as well. Wouldn't it be a great road safety campaign?
Because
there are times where, you know, I'll get a message on the in-game phone and I'm driving along, so I'll just pull that up and have a look at it now, and I see that I'm crashing into things so much more because I'm trying to read this message and drive at the same time. So I'll look at games like that, and wouldn't it be great if there was a road safety game where it's like full-on driving simulator?
Yeah.
And you know, you could say, okay, well, this is what happens when you're talking on a mobile phone, and the dynamics of the car change, and so that it's, you're not handling it as well because you're talking on the phone, you know.
Yeah.
I think things like that would just be amazing.
Well, isn't it kind of you know, if you think about it, isn't it almost kind of ridiculous that in order to pass a you know, the initial driving exam, you have to read this little DMV book or whatever. Wouldn't the most ideal way to be able to get that information be to like actually experience it maybe in a virtual environment? Like, because you could retain all that information so much better, you know?
Absolutely.
And you don't actually have to get behind the wheel of a car yet to risk killing someone to learn how to drive. So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that's really interesting. I mean, you could even get to a point to where, you know, a game could be the initial test to get your permit. You know, as opposed to taking a written test. If you play this game really well and you pass it, then you know the basics, and now you can have a permit, so you can go and learn to drive.
I know with our system, you still have to do the written test.
Yeah.
To get your learner's permit.
Right.
I think it's when you're going through your P's, which is a probationary license, they do have a simulator that you can drive around, and is what it's doing is that they'll send out hazards onto the road, and they're sort of measuring your performance on it, like how well you identify the hazards, your stopping time, and things like that. And so wouldn't it be great if that was the first thing you did?
Yeah.
Rather than, okay, you've been driving on the road for a year, now sit in this computer simulation and just prove to us that you know how to drive a car and,
right.
Stop for when a pedestrian is crossing the road.
Yeah. Actually, this is a really great example. It's like the perfect thing that I like to think about. So, you want to think about, wow, what are games going to be like, in the future? Well, think about things that are already kind of gamified. Something as simple as like taking a test to get your driver's license. That's probably where you're going to see this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, and if it's not something that's being done, well, there's your $1 million idea. Go do it. But when you think about it, it's one of those things where it feels kind of inevitable. I think there's all kinds of testing things that we do in education that could benefit greatly from game experiences. And maybe it doesn't work for everybody, but it'd be a great option in parallel to other options.
Because everyone learns differently. I hate exams.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that I hate it is because, well, there's not going to be a situation where I can't look this shit up.
Right. Whereas with a video game, you kind of want to, like, you want to learn in order to solve the dilemma, you know? There's all kinds of things. You could do a math problem to actually solve something, you know, instead of a story problem, you know, where you're introduced to people you don't know or what. Maybe you can actually look at a person and you know, figure out, like, one great thing with math would be as if you could like have a job simulator. Like, okay, you're gonna work you're gonna work retail at Target.
I have this great idea for a retail simulator, and basically the aim of this game would to be, okay, you're gonna be put in the shoes of the lowly retail pleb, and all the customers around you are just gonna be absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
And my aim with this game is that people will play it and be like, oh man, I should really be nicer to those poor retail plebs.
That would be great. There's so many ways that could go. Like, maybe it starts out pretty easy and you get nothing but nice customers, but as the game progresses, it gets to harder levels. Like, the customers just become more and more, like, demonic over time.
Yeah.
I would love that. but anyway, this has been a really, like, interesting conversation.
Yeah, it has been. I'm
kind of gone all over the place.
It's surprising how much there is in gaming, how many things there are to talk about. I mean, people sort of disregard it as not being important, but it's just amazing the amount of depth and complexity that you can get into.
Yeah, I agree.
Before we close, I'd like to just sort of go over buying advice for gaming hardware and perhaps some game recommendations.
Ooh, yeah, I have some ideas there.
All right, so I think I'll start off with my recommendation. If you don't have a game console or any sort of gaming device at the moment, is hold off on the next gen stuff because it's still going to be a while before we get games coming out, like really good games. That so I think the thing to do at the moment is to buy a 360 or a PS3 or, you know, even a Wii U is still a good bet, but, you know, buy a previous generation game because then you'll still have the whole back catalogue of great games that you'll be able to pick up really cheap because there's, you know, the second-hand market is just amazing for that sort of thing. So you can always pick up bargains along the way and have some great experiences. You know, those are still really good games. And when you do eventually decide to get a next-gen console, my advice is always work out what game you want to buy and then buy, like, if it's console exclusive, buy the console that it's on. If the games that you want to play, if they're cross-platform, then it doesn't so matter so much. So then you need to do a little bit more research into which console you're going to get. But I think it's kind of useless to get hung up on which console you're buying. Just focus on the games because that's what you're going to be. That's the whole reason that you're buying these machines for. So look for what gaming experiences that you want and then buy the hardware according to that. That's always my advice.
I agree with that 100%. If I have anything to sort of maybe add to that, let's see. I think... And so there's a lot of people that I know that surprisingly like are not interested in gaming at all. It's sort of strange, but there's actually like a number of people that I talk to who just like don't, for whatever reason, maybe they were once into gaming, but then kind of got out of games or people that have never been interested in games. They just never really saw the point. And the thing I would actually recommend for that kind of person is actually a 3DS or a 2DS. Either one. The 2DS is like really, you know, perfectly good. And, you know, the only thing missing from it is the 3D feature, which really isn't, you know, that big of a deal. It's not going to break any game that I've played so far. But, you know, I think there's just a ton of value in playing games, and I think I think Nintendo, you know, for all the stuff that we said in this episode about Nintendo, it's a great like entry point into trying to understand like what is interesting about gaming, and you know, the Nintendo still kind of remains like the sort of the Pixar of the video game world, and that they don't they really don't. Even though, you know, we talked about how they're not like pushing things forward that far, they don't know how to make a bad game. Like every game they make is full of detail and, you know, delightful stuff. I just recently played like Zelda Link Between Worlds and you know, Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon, and they're just these delightful, really super polished experiences that didn't have any glitches whatsoever, you know, and they're just a lot of fun. And I think anybody who is on the fence about playing games at all, or just like hasn't been into games and, you know, would kind of maybe like to get back into them, I think that's like the best option on the table, like for something that's cheap and something that you can kind of do on the side, you know. That'd be my recommendation, along with agreeing with everything that Clinton said.
Yeah. So I always think that Nintendo is a great place to start if you're introducing someone to gaming. I mean, it's absolutely no good just throwing them into Call of Duty and saying, well, off you go.
Yeah.
Because that's just going to turn them off the experience completely. What you really want to do is get them started on something that they're going to have lots of fun with. And it's Nintendo titles. They provide a lot of fun.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, so are there any games that you'd recommend?
Like, let's see, lately, what am I playing? For the 2DS or just in general?
Oh, just in general. Any game that you enjoy and, like, just would absolutely love to have more people playing.
Okay, so there's actually one game that comes very specifically to mind. Republic for iOS.
Yeah.
So this is a game that started out as actually a Kickstarter project, and the entire idea behind it was that it was actually a lot of what we talked about on this episode. There's been a lot of attempts to do something new, you know, with touch controls, but you haven't seen like a lot of the AAA players going to make like a AAA experience that really takes advantage of the platform. And so what these guys endeavored to do, and many of them are behind, I think the director of the game is the producer of like the last Halo game, and Halo 4 and Metal Gear Solid 4. So like these guys are like industry veterans, and they couldn't get funding from like any publishers. Publishers were not interested in doing something where they'd invest a ton of upfront cash into building the kind of game that they wanted to do. So they took it to Kickstarter, and they managed to get, I can't remember how much they got funding for, but I think it was like over $500,000 or something like that. And so they've been working on this game, and it finally got released. And I personally think it's a bit of a step forward. It has some problems in that like older hardware, it tends to crash on quite a bit. But if you've got if you got anything newer to play it on, or if you're willing to do some serious management with your iPad Mini, it's worth playing. The entire game you can play. It has just like one touch controls basically. Like it doesn't have an on-screen pad or directional pad or anything of that sort. You sort of just tap around to play the whole game. And it actually has it's a very compelling experience with a lot more depth than you would think would be possible with that kind of gameplay. And it's got a lot of production value, really great like voice acting. It's got David Hayter is one of the voices in the game. He's the voice of Solid Snake in the Metal Gear Solid series. And it's just, it's a really, really cool game. I think everyone should check that out.
Yeah, I'll definitely have a look at that one. It's one that I haven't heard of.
Oh, really? It's been talked about quite a bit. It kind of had a really big splash right when it first came out, and then it kind of fell down the charts a bit, but the ratings on the game have been fantastic. So I think it's maybe a sleeper title. And also the first one that they've released is sort of just the first chapter. So you can buy that, and I think it's like, I don't know, it's like $5. And then in the game, there's like an in-app purchase. If you liked the first one, they're currently, they're working on the next four chapters, I think. And you can actually in-app purchase the next four chapters in advance if you want to if you want to support the cause of them completing this story, which I think is a really really cool way to do it.
So it won't be released as a separate app, it'll just be DLC within the app.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Cool. And another thing about these guys, the name of their studio is Camouflage, and they've been doing just like a lot of really cool things with this game. They released the soundtrack. They've got like an accompanying ebook. They do a podcast actually, where they since the end of the Kickstarter, they've been doing a podcast sort of tracking the development. So if you're interested in game development and want to know like how this game was created, they've got like hours and hours and hours of commentary, you know, from the early stages of the game all the way up to when it was released. So that's something really cool that they did too. So.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's my pick, I suppose.
All right. My pick. I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I still really want more people to play BioShock Infinite, and I've had a lot of fun with that. And one of the reasons that I think that this is such a great game is just the impact that it has on you. And I was talking about how, in a first-person game, you're kind of experiencing things more directly than you are in any other sort of game. So there are lots of moments in BioShock Infinite which are pretty confronting. But yeah, it's just a phenomenal story. The gameplay is so much fun. Jumping around on the sky rails and from platform to platform is just amazing. And the ending of it is just something that is mind blowing. I don't want to go into any sort of detail about it. I just want people to play it so that I actually have other people to talk about it with.
Yeah, I feel bad now because I mentioned it in the sort of the plethora of games where you just go around shooting people. I know that's not quite the case because I've talked to people about it and they've all come away saying like it was a mind blowing game. So I just don't have any good hardware to play it on is my problem.
Yeah, it is a problem with gaming that you have to have that hardware to be able to do it. But It's available on the Mac App Store. It's available on Steam, Xbox, PS3. So, it's around. And if you wait for a sale, you get it cheap. I mean, the Mac App Store, they had it on sale last year. But and talking about the like games where you're just shooting people, there's actually an entire segment of the game where the protagonist Booker DeWitt, like he's going through and he just doesn't want to kill anyone. But there's just people coming out all over the place trying to get him, and he's like, "Look, I really don't want to. I don't want to do this. I'm sick of killing people. I don't want to kill anyone else. But you absolutely have to because your survival depends on it." So it's interesting.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. To really sort of and I think it. That sort of reflected how I was feeling, that I'm kind of like, I really don't want to have to go into another firefight right now. And the character is saying exactly the same thing. It's, I have to kill more people. I'm not up for this. But yeah,
That reminds me so much of a moment at the end of Metal Gear Solid, where your best friend is basically being pinned by a Metal Gear. And you have the Solid Snake is trying to make the decision: do I blow up the Metal Gear, even though my friend is there, And every time you go to fire, Snake goes, "No, it's no good. You can't do it. You can't do it." It's kind of a rudimentary idea, the same kind of thing. But I love that when games turn the tables and sort of play with the psychology a bit.
Yeah, there's all sorts of moments. So if you're looking for like a real serious experience, Bioshock Infinite is the one to go for, because there's just so many moments, so many jaw-dropping moments in that game that it's just stunning. So I can't recommend it highly enough.
You have me wanting to go get a PS3.
Yeah.
I really should. I haven't even played Journey. Like that's how out of the loop I actually am.
Yeah, I'm hoping that Journey comes out on like they re-release it on another platform because I have no justification for buying a PS3.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that on PC one day so that I can play it.
It seems like it would come to the Vita eventually.
Yeah.
No one has a Vita except for me.
Maybe I'd have more of an excuse to buy a Vita.
Yeah. We'll save the Vita for another time. I have lots of thoughts about the Vita.
Yeah.
But this has been fun, Clinton. I'm really happy that you invited me on. I'm sorry that this went on for this long.
No, like I said when we were preparing the show, there's so much to talk about. I honestly don't care if we go on forever about this.
It's been kind of epic though, so I'm looking forward to this episode coming out.
Yes. This was Anodized. Don't forget to check out anodizedpodcast.com for the show notes, more information on the show, and bonus material. You can follow Anodized on Twitter and nap.net at anodizedpodcast. If you have any comments or feedback, mention us. You can also head over to anodizedpodcast.com/contact to send something a little bit more in-depth. You can follow Zach on Twitter and app.net. We'll have a link for him in the show notes, so you can head over there and click on it. Don't forget to check out his site, holeandpart.com, and listen to his podcast with Andrew J. Clark, The Menu Bar. You can follow me on Twitter and app.net at Clinton1550. I occasionally write stuff at insanelygreat.com. Rate us on iTunes, leave us a review. Tell your friends about the show. It's the best way to help us out. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time.